Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco, blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of unobtainium. Greetings to all of you from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp, your occasional host, designated driver of the airwaves, and moderator of tonight's upcoming cacophony of conversation. Glad to be back with you once again. Hope you all had wonderful and memorable Valentine's Day experiences with your sweeties, or maybe for some of you, Valentine's weekends instead of just Valentine's Day, as it might be for some of you. We got a good one for you tonight. Two excellent guests, both of them accomplished professional women, both passionate about their areas of research, both here to talk about topics that have previously been considered, matters of the paranormal. But is it time that science caught up? Caught up to those of us like those who listen to Coast, those of us who are non-scientists but have known for a long time that something's going on out there which has not been fully explored or explained. Maybe so. Maybe it's time for these subjects to be labeled as emerging sciences, or at least something worthy of scientific inquiry. In the second half of tonight's program, a fresh look at one of the most famous UFO cases of all time. Now, you might think you know the basic story of the Phoenix Lights, you know about the big giant floating triangle over Phoenix, but I'm confident there's a whole range of information you don't know about. This is perhaps the UFO case that has more witnesses than any other, at least any other that's been researched this far, and few other cases have this much evidence behind them. Not only eyewitnesses, but video and photos and film footage, government documents, and most tellingly, perhaps, government lies to go along with it. So many cover stories and flimsy attempts to cloud the issue that this disinformation itself screams at us that something weird unfolded in the desert skies above Arizona and other areas, for that matter. The principal researcher in this case, the woman for whom it's been an unmitigated passion, is Dr. Lynn Kitai. She joins us later tonight to talk about new information, new witnesses, new proof in this very important case. But coming up in a couple of minutes, an equally intriguing topic, the search for Bigfoot evidence. You will recall a couple of months ago I had as my guest Dr. Melba Ketchum, and she was here to tell us about spearheading a search for DNA evidence, proof that a new an unknown species, some kind of big primate, exists among us. Call it Bigfoot if you want to. She's been working on a paper about her findings, been trying to get it published, and it's finally out. Dr. Ketchum is giving us the first interview since the release of her paper, and I really can't wait to jump into the nuts and bolts of this groundbreaking study. She joins us, as I said, in just a couple of minutes. Webmaster Lex and I have put together our usual assortment of oddities and news items in our Knapp's News section on the Coast to Coast website. Included is an update on the Russian meteor incident. Quite a cleanup underway, and that's a headline you don't see every day. Meteor rescue operation underway. If there's only one article that you read from our news list, though, I hope it's the one about the case of the soldier who shot Osama bin Laden. You know, we make so much hoopla in this country, and rightfully so, about giving respect to our military men and women. Lots of rah-rah-rah, support the troop stuff. But too often when they come home, after defending our country, after defending our way of life, they're on their own. And being on their own is not a pretty picture in many cases. It's a national disgrace, in my opinion, and I think you might agree after you read this article. Also on our Knapp's News list, a couple of fun hypotheticals, including an answer to that age-old burning scientific question, how much does Thor's hammer weigh? And a not-so-flattering commentary about some well-known arch-skeptics and debunkers and how they think, or rather, how they don't really think. Take a look at the Knapp's News items and the rest of the material on the Coast to Coast website when you get a moment. Two quick news items. If you are not a country music fan, this name will not be familiar, but a country singer named Mindy McCready was found dead tonight. She's a young woman in her 30s. She had a lot of big hits on the country charts, but also a lot of personal turmoil, cause of death not yet known. Another name you might not know but should is that of Dr. Frederick Alzaphone, a physicist and mathematician who was an associate of another courageous scientist, Dr. Hal Puthoff. That's a name often mentioned on this program. Dr. Al-Zafan was a rarity in science circles in that he had a keen interest in UFOs, in exotic propulsion, and he saw these kinds of topics as legitimate for a physicist to tackle. He had a PhD from Berkeley. He worked with Dr. Puthoff at Stanford Research Institute, worked in the aerospace industry, and was a pioneer in so many ways. He died a couple of days ago at the age of 93, one of the good guys from what I've been told, though I did not have the pleasure of knowing him. One of the biggest news stories this week is one that may or may not have been reported in your hometown paper. It's about Sasquatch, Bigfoot. Are we finally closing in on physical evidence of his existence? That's what Dr. Melba Ketchum thinks. She joins me right after our first break. We got some great conversation, good tunes, and much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast. I'm George Knapp. As you might recall from a couple of months ago, Dr. Melba Ketchum founded a company called DNA Diagnostics in 1985. It's become a leader in all types of DNA testing, including human and animal forensics, human and animal paternity and parentage testing, disease diagnostics. She's been on the front lines of some pretty big DNA questions, worldwide research projects, but I don't think she's ever tackled anything quite like Sasquatch, Bigfoot. She's been trying to get this paper published for a while, has suffered slings and arrows, both from within the Bigfoot community and within the scientific community, and now she has a chance to answer back. Dr. Ketchum, great to have you back on the program.
Thank you for having me, George.
Melba, did you know it was going to be quite this tough sledding in terms of getting the paper published when you
Absolutely
started?
Absolutely not. I thought it would be a piece of cake because the science was good, and I was naive enough to believe that, and I believe you use those words, and naive is a good one.
But you thought, well, gosh, the science is good, and the topic is so interesting. How could they possibly resist taking a look at this, an honest look at it, right?
Absolutely.
And it's been anything but that?
I was floored.
Tell me about this journal, De Novo. I don't know about it. I know it's a relatively new journal, which is one of the criticisms that I saw online this week. Well, gosh, Melba must have made up this this journal herself.
Well, that's not the case, and I've sent you documentation, haven't I, to this point?
Yes.
What happened was that after having a lot of biased review, and I mean seriously biased review, and I sent you documentation of that also, We found a young journal that was fairly new, and we were submitted our manuscript there because they were leaning more toward next-generation sequencing technologies, which is how we got our genomes. And I spoke with the editor. The editor agreed to send it out to people that, you know, worked with next-generation sequencing. And we got back passing reviews, passed with revision, and then we made some revision and responses, and we were told that the journal would publish, and it was legitimate peer review. I have no idea who they were. I have the peer reviews. I believe I sent you the peer reviews where you could see where they accepted it from the button that was pushed at the top of the reviews. And once we received the reviews back and they agreed to publish, we were ready to send out a press release. And all of a sudden, just a few minutes before we were going live with it, I get this email, which I've furnished to you. Basically, the editor is saying that his lawyer, doesn't want him publishing this. And in a further conversation, and as alluded to in the email, the lawyer will quit him if he goes ahead and publishes this. Also, that it scared him so bad that he was afraid it would ruin his career, much like it's ruined mine. Because nobody wants to be associated with something that's allegedly a myth. And therefore, they backed out at the last minute. So he felt really bad, and I was able to actually acquire that journal because that was the only way I was going to be able to take those peer reviews and some legitimacy with it because, otherwise we'd have to find another journal. Well, we've already spent nearly 2 years with journals, and I'm not going to wait another 5 years to go through 100 journals to get one that will be fair.
If we could even get one.
So we acquired that journal and very quickly threw together a new website, new name, and published it. Now, I've had nothing to do with the publishing. The people we acquired it from, they helped make changes and put it up and had it ready to go for us, more or less. It still has some flaws, but we wanted to get the paper on out because it's been long enough.
You were hoping that just the subject is interesting enough that even if you didn't write the paper and dot all your I's and cross all your T's to everyone's specification, that they would at least think, wow, this is a novel approach. It's an interesting topic. It's earth-shattering. It's an importance. Let's take a look at it. Let's at least publish it, put it out there, let people read it and evaluate it. But that, I read the give and take between you and a couple of these journals, and it's outrageous. I mean, it's not... It was my impression that some of the complaints from some of these people who sent in comments were from people who had not read the paper at all.
Yes, that's absolutely true, because I would come back with our response that's already in the manuscript if you will read it, basically. And that happened multiple times. And not only that, there was one review that mocked me. I think the worst thing that happened was one of the major publications wanted to have another look at the paper. They said, make all these changes, document that you've done everything they've asked you to do, and then send it back to us. Well, we did that, only they asked us for if we could get just one genome. We got three, and they were the same species. They also, when we pulled the mito out, it was the same mitochondrial sequence as we had done individually prior to the whole genomes. I mean, it's definitive proof. And when we sent it back, one of them wouldn't even review it. And then there were three others that, there was no excuse. One of them still didn't read it. And the other one just didn't believe it.
The phrase that is used in your paper is the information, the data, is consistent, reproducible, and novel. You had to beat around the bush last time you were here. You didn't want to spill all the beans before you... the paper was published. Tell us now. Give us the thumbnail sketch of what the paper says, what your findings were.
Okay. The first thing we did was when we extracted these samples, two labs extracted, both forensic labs extracted these samples. We washed the samples. We did all the techniques. We screened them for contamination, and there was none. We went in there and then screened for species with mammalian primers, which makes it where any animal would show up, including human. And all of our samples came back human. And this was after the hair had already been looked at by a forensic hair specialist that does primarily human but also animal. And he had said it was novel. It was not the same. It was not human hair. And it didn't match any of his animal knowns that it was tested against. So we knew we had good clean DNA. We went forward after screening, and we started outsourcing because I knew there would be a problem with if just one or two labs did this. So we sent these samples out. Nobody knew what they were. And we sent the samples to Family Tree DNA. They specialize in mitochondrial DNA. We got 20 whole genomes, 10 partial genomes, and the rest of the samples we just screened because, I mean, you get that many that are running the same, that pretty well tells the story. Non-human hair given human sequence. And then, we had some non-hair samples in there, too, but the majority of it was hair. And once we got those results, we knew that they didn't exactly look human, so we decided to go after the nuclear DNA, which the mitochondrial DNA I might offer is maternally related. It comes from your mother only, whereas your nuclear DNA comes from your mother and your father. So we started with the nuclear DNA, and we started getting really strange results. And normally when you run a particular primer pair, and we tried to do as many universal primers as we could, as well as human and ape-specific primers, whenever you select a particular spot you're going to amplify on the DNA, you'll get, you've seen on TV where they have gels with bands on it, and they all are just running across at the same level. Well, that's what you get. Well, we didn't get that at all. We got weird-looking bands that were all different sizes, yet we had already species-identified them as human. And so this was bizarre, and I didn't tell them once again what they had. So I get this email from one of the PhDs at the lab we outsourced nuclear testing to. We also let them do some mito testing to back up the other mito. And she said, we got this really weird fragment. It's not as long as it should be. It's like 490-something bases, and we were supposed to get 500 and some odd bases. And a base pair is just the building block of DNA, and the length of it is in base pairs. So So with that said, it was a shorter one, and she blasted it in GenBank. Now, GenBank is a sequence depository that all the scientists, they put their sequences in, and then you can go compare your unknown sequence to it. Well, she blasted it, and it didn't come up matching anything that's ever been put in GenBank out of millions of sequences. And so she writes in this email, she says, "What did you send me? We don't know what this is. Have you discovered a new species? I have that in an email." And so we finally had to tell them what they were testing. So,
and they didn't like it.
No, none of them liked it. I take it back. A family tree was very much the nicest one about it. But some of the others, we had one threaten us if we used their name, we couldn't use it.
But you paid them. You paid them. You had to use the results.
They wouldn't take
right?
our money when they found out.
Well, that's not very scientific.
And wouldn't let us use anything. We did get our pictures out of it, and that was it.
But I mean, they did the work. It's not like Dr. Melba, crazy Dr. Melba, in the closet in her house doing all the DNA testing.
No. We chose the best places in the country to do it.
Right.
I shopped around and found out who had the best reputations. They were accredited labs. They were major university labs. There were state crime labs. I mean, this was not my little lab. It was really big name labs. Texas A&M, they backed up the results I wasn't able to use the name of. They did it. They saw the same strangeness that the other university did.
Help me understand this, Melba. Okay, so, you know, a lot of the emails that I've got after your last appearance here and since then, people say, I don't understand it. Why can't it just be human? And I know in some of the criticisms, and we'll get into this a little bit more later, but they'll say, well, gosh, it must be human contamination. But you have hairs, these hairs that have human and non-human DNA in them. It's not contaminated. It's not some other species. It's one species with this two kinds of DNA inside, right?
No, that's not quite right.
Okay.
Right. What you've got is, you know, a physical hair that's about the size of a horse mane hair and wavy. And it's about 3 or 4 inches long. And it's got a natural end on it. It's never been cut. It's never been dyed. When you look at it under the microscope by a forensic hair analyst, it does both human and animal. And he had a whole lot of knowns of North American animals to compare it to. It didn't fit any species that he had seen before. So he screened it first. We've got non-human hair. It's twice as big as human hair. And then we test it, and the DNA from those hairs in 100% of the cases was modern human female mitochondrial DNA. It was no animal DNA in it. It was the hair that was animal-looking.
Okay. So those who say, well, gosh, it looks to me like it's all human. There's nothing novel about it.
Well, that was fine until we went into the nuclear testing,
right?
The whole genomes and what have you, and the different places on the DNA that we looked at for the first time. And then we found all this really strange sequence that's just not in GenBank. I mean, there'll be bits of human sequence in it, but then there'll be a lot of novel sequence, different sequence in there that's not ever been, you know. One thing about it, at least we could use GenBank to blast with or to check the sequences against what's in GenBank without uploading them. So we were able to do that, and we have trees to that effect. A lot of the supplementary data is trees that were generated directly on GenBank.
One of the things I did not understand, and I'm asking you now to help me and us non-scientists understand this, is you mentioned in the paper about 16 different types and you're suggesting that these individuals were not all from the same area. How do you make that determination? And am I explaining that correctly?
No, that's right. Basically, when you do mitochondrial DNA testing, you know, it's very popular nowadays to have your mitochondrial DNA tested so you know what your origins were, where you came from.
Right.
And it's like a big tree, and it starts out in Africa, and then it moves to the Middle East, and then it starts branching into Europe and branching into Asia. And each different mutation, the mutations happen just ever so often, very slowly with mitochondrial DNA. So when it mutates and becomes a new type and makes a new branch, where that happened, usually you can kind of trace the DNA to that particular spot. So, you know, say somebody is Native American, they would have a branch that would come out of from the Middle East through Asia and across the Bering Bridge into the North America.
Okay.
And a particular group assignment of a letter designation, like a C or a D, for instance, are both Native American types that have originally came through Asia and across into North America.
But you can, as you talked about this before, but just to reiterate, you can weed out an animal. It's not a possum. It's not a bear. I mean, the labs you're sending it to, they can tell right away, right?
Oh, absolutely. You know, because the thing is, when you do, when you sequence the mitochondrial DNA, that's what forensic scientists use for a species test, is you have, you know, these universal primers that'll work on everything, and you sequence your DNA from them, and it's going to tell you what species you got.
Okay. Much more to come with Dr. Melba Ketchum about this groundbreaking study looking at DNA samples from purported Bigfoot. Stay with us, everyone. Much more to come on Coast to Coast. We're talking with Dr. Melba Ketchum about a groundbreaking study of DNA in purported Bigfoot creatures. And she's got about 111 samples that were analyzed in blind tests conducted by several reputable DNA labs. The results are astonishing, and yet the reaction in the scientific community, kind of across the board, you got a couple of scientists who are saying, well, that's kind of interesting. I'd like to know more about that, which is the reaction you'd hope you'd get. And then you've got some people that say it's absolute nonsense. It's totally ridiculous. It can't be, and therefore it isn't. And you get the feeling that some of those folks didn't really read the paper. It certainly didn't read it with an open mind. We get back into the nuts and bolts about this study right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. My guest is Dr. Melba Ketchum. Dr. Ketchum, where can people read the paper?
The denovojournal.com is the link to get to the paper, and there are links to download it from there.
Okay. And are a lot of people downloading so far?
They were until we had a glitch with the website because it was put together in a hurry. So, but I think we've got that fixed now, so it'll be available for download anytime somebody wants it.
All right, you had 111 samples that were tested, collected by different researchers around the country. Dave Politis, I know, and his North American Bigfoot folks helped you find some. So what kind of quality control testing do you do on the samples?
On quite a few of them, we actually had the people that gathered the sample, we had their DNA to compare it to make sure that, their DNA wasn't contaminating it. We also have all the lab people on file, so we knew it wasn't any of our lab people either. Like I said, we washed the samples. A lot of the samples came from either eyewitness or controlled areas where there were sightings. The Erickson Project, for instance, they actually had a study going on that was overseen by a PhD in wildlife biology, and most of the collectors did use gloves and did proper procedure in actually collecting the hair. The Erickson Project collected saliva, and they would use sterile paper plates because most of your paper products when packaged are sterile and, or close to it, and therefore they're a good thing to use. They use paper plates with sandpaper that's glued to it to help pick up extra cells for the DNA, and they would put it in Tupperware, so you'd have to have a hand to open it. And then they would wait for them to come in and eat. The Sasquatch got used to eating, these plates. And the people that lived on the site would prepare it, so they were not scared of the people particularly. They'd come in, they would eat the meal, and then they would collect the plate, immediately take it in, put it in a brand new bag, and put it in the freezer. So, there were eyewitness sightings along with research projects that were well run under the circumstances. The other good thing about the Erickson samples, especially, we have a little short video that we went ahead and released to the public of the one that's nicknamed Matilda. She's a young female sleeping in the woods. That particular family unit was very unusual in that they got so used to their people and used to being fed that, they could actually come pretty close to them at times. And so that's a very good video for sample 37, which is one of the few female samples in the study.
There's a guy who, of course, became famous because he claimed to have killed a Bigfoot, maybe more than one, and he had a couple of samples of Bigfoot meat that he supposedly sent out. And even now, after your paper is out, I see you getting blasted online by people who say that either you lied about the meat or he lied or I guess the question is that meat from a purported Bigfoot part of your study?
Yes, it is. And I'm going to give you my opinion of what I think has happened. First of all, anybody can go online and look and tell that the pictures, the two samples are different. The picture in our paper we have, it's long, wavy, mostly white hair. There's no undercoat. The sample is not dried looking. You can see fresh, pretty fresh meat on it, you know, muscle tissue and subcutaneous tissues. And that's why we turned it up where you could see both the haired side and the fresh side. And we even had, one of the complaints was that our samples were degraded. We even had histopathology done, and the cells were all intact. It was fresh. There was no bacteria to speak of on the sample. So very, very pristine sample. If you look, there's a certain blogger out there that put some pictures up about the one that they sent to Canada. Well, first of all, the DNA is different, so it's a different sample. Let's just start by saying that. If it had been the same sample, the DNA would have run the same. Second, and we have, you know, tremendous amounts of testing. We have a whole genome on that one, whereas they took 7 months to get, you know, just a very small section of mitochondrial DNA, among other things. So with that said, though, you can look at the picture and see that there's an undercoat on the samples that ended up in Canada. My opinion is that perhaps they got worried because these things are human to a large extent, and there could be, you know, repercussions because of that. I really think that's what happened, but that's just my opinion.
I'd want to reemphasize this. You mentioned it sort of in passing during our first segment together, but I think it really bears repeating, and that is that one of the labs that had one of these samples was curious about it. They sent it to something called GenLab, which is this gigantic bank of DNA information, and it didn't match anything else. Am I understating?
Oh, we did that all through the paper. We started out, we blasted the individual testing and the mitochondrial testing, and then when we did the whole genomes, once we aligned a section, well, we did 2.7 million bases. Across approximately, there were the three samples varied some, but they approximately the largest one was 2.7 million bases, and I think it was 2.4 million bases. These samples, we could keep them in our system, but yet blast them or search against GenBank, which is your depository. When you publish a paper, you're supposed to put this into GenBank for other scientists to look at, which we attempted to do. Now, I sent you a thread of emails from one of my co-authors trying to get this done, and I'd ask you to make a comment on that.
Well, I mean, it's pretty weird that, you know, it certainly does look like they don't want it going in there.
Right. They refused it. They wouldn't accept it because it didn't have a species name attached. So we wrote them back, basically, and then it said that, use human, use Homo sapien. But if you do, we have to have a signed written permission from the donor. I mean, good luck getting a Sasquatch to sign their DNA over to us. And a couple other rules that they had in there. So we couldn't do that. And
you can't just put it in GenBank blind.
No, you have to fill out all this information
okay.
on it.
All right.
And whenever they found out apparently what the subject matter was, they... They just came back, and finally we said, if you don't do it, you know, if you don't let us put it in, we don't know what the species is because there's not a species name on it yet. You know, we can't do this. This is the whole point of our paper, is that this is a new hominin, and we want to get these sequences in. And if you don't get back with us, I mean, we'll just have to put it in with the paper, which is what we've done. We've provided those sequences that we used in the paper as supplementary data. You know, for people to look at. I mean, we're transparent with this. We didn't want any problems with this, but, you know, that's why I sent you the documentation. People, I think that I'm just saying this stuff, but I've got the paper trail to prove it, and I hope you can acknowledge that.
I do acknowledge it, and I hope that you'll put that information, that trail of information and paperwork where other people can read it. Let me ask you this question, Melba. The idea of interspecies mating, that, you know, we humans, we can't mate with a chimpanzee. How do you figure this can work, that somewhere 13,000 or more years ago, these two species mixed?
Well, first of all, the species identity shows it to be human. But when you look at your whole genome nuclear DNA, it is so different that it must have been just kind of a fluke to happen that way. I think that's one reason the established scientific community really has a problem with this, because they've not seen something like this, not to this degree. Now, it's been proven that we have little bits of, as a human species, that, some of us have some Neanderthal in us, and which is another species of human, and some of us have some Denisovan from Russia, the finger bone that was found. We have some genes left from that particular hominid. This really isn't different, except it's kind of in reverse, in that we're probably the lesser amount of human DNA in the nuclear part of the DNA than it is with us and the Neanderthal and Denisovans. But it's still kind of a similar scenario. But the sticking point is that the mitochondrial DNA is 100% human. The other sticking point is that it's a recent hybridization. I had a real interesting a scientist come forth and actually support our strange electron microscopy on it, where we had double-stranded DNA and then single-stranded DNA, and he was talking about that this would happen if the hybrids didn't fit real well together, because you have stretches of sequence that just didn't align with one another, and, that kind of made sense. Some of the scientific community is starting to come out, and we have, now sent it. We're asked if we would let, some more famous, quote, scientists look at it than what I am, and we've already sent the data over to them, so there'll be some independent analysis. Even though we've done everything about twice on all of this, they're going to get their shot at it, and plus we're letting, certain scientists, really go through the paper. As long as they are open-minded, they'll see how much science is in the paper, but they have to be open-minded to start with.
Well, we'll come back to that idea, because there's a lot of them out there that certainly are not open-minded, at least the reactions I've read so far. Again, back to this interspecies mating point, it's not still going on. It happened a long time ago. You're not saying any of this is still going on, do you?
Well, there's reports, and I can't really verify them.
That's outside the bounds of the paper, right? That's outside what you're...
Outside of the paper. This is... when you go on the Internet, you start... First of all, there's a real famous case that was in the 1890s in Russia, the story of Zaina and her son Quit. And this was a young female Sasquatch, or wild men as they call them, that was captured by a mayor of a town or some official like that. And he kept her and used her to carry heavy things and what have you. He semi-domesticated her to the point that she was allowed to walk loose in town. And when they would throw parties, she would be the prize for some of the men in the community. And she ended up having six children. The first two, and these were by human males in the community. The first two, she drowned in the river because she went to wash them after she gave birth, and it was cold water. Obviously, our human nature is not as sturdy. And the next four, they took from her immediately and were raised by townspeople. And, they looked a little different, and the skull on her son Quit was very different morphologically. So they actually did have the DNA done, and they got human mitochondrial DNA from him and from her alleged skull also. Here we are with human DNA again. Of course, critics say, oh, well, they were just humans. But yet, as late as the 1990s, there was a lady that was about 100 years old that was able to give a really clear eyewitness account of Zaina and the way that she behaved and the way that she looked, very compelling. And then there's another case in Washington of a gentleman that was the product of a woman, a Native American woman that was abducted allegedly and came back pregnant and had a son. And this son allegedly had some really nice qualities about, he was a horse whisperer. He could talk to animals and they would understand him, it seemed. And, he had several very odd traits about him. So allegedly that is another true. There's a lot of reports out there. Those are probably the two most famous. There was actually a little scientific study or a thesis done on this mating by a PhD in the Pacific Northwest.
So the Sasquatch that witnesses say they see, we know they have human DNA in them, the ones that are running around, but we're not quite sure how many humans might have Sasquatch DNA.
Yes, and that's going to be an interesting study. I've got a couple of people that think they might have such. And, you know, if we can get funding, we'll probably go ahead and do their genomes and see if how well they align with regular human genomes.
Any Neanderthal DNA in the Sasquatch?
Not that we've seen. But, you know, there's still, it takes years to analyze whole genomes, and three of them is a huge undertaking. So, you know, it'll be a while before we know all of this. But we did some specific, we knew certain places to look for Neanderthal, and we did not find it.
You know, the criticism you hear the most is, well, gosh, why can't we see some of this stuff? At least, we'll get into specifics, but I mean, some of these guys said, well, put out all the data. We don't see the data. Where is the raw data? And why won't she let us see it? You said you have shared this with some other independent scientists who are seemingly open-minded. Is there any a plan to say a more widespread release? Put something where the genetics community of the world can take a look at it.
They have offered to help us get it in GenBank. They will put pressure on GenBank. So it will be in GenBank. Like I say, though, although it's available right now with the paper, we've got a text file of the sequences, even up to 2.7 million bases, because text is not extremely large. So we were able to use everything, put out everything in the paper in a couple of supplemental files. And, you know, if you go to that link I sent you, you just click on the supplemental number, and the chart pops up, and you can see the data.
Am I correct in saying this is just the beginning? I mean, you don't claim that this is the end-all, be-all.
No.
You're just getting started. The sequencing numbers and, yeah.
All this is to prove that they exist, that, you know, some of these came from eyewitness samples, a lot of them did. And, you know, therefore, and somebody sees it, they collect it, they send it. We get the same results across the different samples. The genomes did align in the same spot on the phylogenetic tree, so it shows that the samples came from the same species, which has not been seen before. And people are saying that they saw Sasquatch where they got these samples. So with that said, that pretty well tells you what they are.
I saw one critic who said, well, look, this is meaningless unless you've got video to go along with the sample. You should have video of Bigfoot in the forest and leaving his hair sample on the tree, and that would prove that the sample is from Bigfoot.
Well, we have the video of sample 37, Matilda sleeping in the woods. And the Erickson Project has definitive footage. But, you know, the problem with that is, I mean, look how clear the Patterson-Gimlin film is. And they're still arguing whether it's real or not. Video will never prove it, because there's always going to be somebody making an excuse that it's not real, just like they're trying to do with the DNA. But you can't fake DNA like what we have and what we've done, where it's repeatable on a large-scale basis.
You can't fake it.
No, you can't fake that. Because if you, like, you know, to me, the largest criticism is, oh, the samples are contaminated. Well, the thing is, you have what's called, when you do the next generation sequencing, there's a quality score. And when you prepare the libraries to sequence, it's a competitive reaction. So if you have, say, two different types of organisms, it's going to use up your reagents quicker, and you're not going to get as much repetition of the sequences. So it will affect your quality score. And I talked to the people that make that machine, and it was two supervisors, actually. And I asked them, I said, is there any way to tell if our sequences are contaminated? Because somebody had mentioned the Genome Center had probably contaminated them. And even though they only test human, and they were saying they contaminated it with animal. So we actually had a conversation, and immediately the comeback was, well, you know, if it's contaminated due to the competitive nature of the reaction to prepare for the sequencing, your quality scores would drop down to 40 or 50. And I said, well, what's an average one? And he says, probably about 85 for just the average genome that's done on humans. And their actual printout about quality scores says 80 or above. All three of our genomes were 88 and better. So we were way above what the average quality score is.
Dr. Melba Ketchum is my guest, talking about her groundbreaking Bigfoot DNA study. Much more to come on this this part of the conversation, including covering some of the criticisms that have been raised so far.